Hello, you're listening to a Zen Studies Society podcast. To learn more about our community of Zen Buddhist practitioners, please visit zenstudies.org.
Shōman katto shu daigo jugo sok choko kishu koji nibaku choko sake o kitsu sureba riko yo. Entangling Vines, Case 55. Mr. Cho drinks wine. A person of old said, Mr. Cho drinks wine. Mr. Li gets drunk. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Today, the day has a very mellow feeling. It's not too hot, it's not too cold. The wind is not too strong, the wind is not too weak. The birds sing their mellow tunes, and we mellow out on the cushions as well. It's an interesting place to be after several days of engaging in this very structured activity of seshin, that we arrive at some kind of loosened up state that in itself still can be very, very clear. And it is the clarity of this human heart, of the kokoro, of that mind of ours, where I shouldn't really say ours. Who does it belong to? No spiritual capitalism here. This, even this, to say this, is already off the mark. But by now, I trust in having felt that mellow energy that still is very strong, that you can connect with what I'm trying to express in one of the worst tools we have, namely words. What more need we seek? And it happens to be the topic of the koan that arrived today. It's such an interesting thing to select a collection of koans, and the Shūman Katto Shū, Entangling Vines, is such a collection of koans. And I've said it many times, but I don't get tired of repeating myself. This Shūman Katto Shū, Entangling Vines, is a little different than the other koan collections that we know so well. We know that Soryu Roshi is translating currently Yamamoto Genpo Roshi's Teisho on Mumonkan. So the Mumonkan, the gateless barrier, is one of those collections that we all know. And the Heikigan Roku, the Blue Cliff Record, another one. And then there's this Shūman Katto Shū, which is just a little bit different because it only contains the main cases. The other collections that I mentioned, they have commentary, they have an opening, they have a main case, they have comments through generations and generations of teachers and human beings practicing in this Rinzai tradition. And if you go to the gift store, you will find also a little, it's not that little, it's tall and it's wide book of the transmission of the Hekigan Roku through the Hakuin lineage, also translated by Soryu Roshi. Here, in this Shumon Katoshu, there's only the central piece of the cases. No opening verses, no pointers, no verses after, no commentaries. So it's a very bare bones kind of a thing. And there are over 270 cases in there. And when people who are in the business of giving talks on one of these collections commit to a collection, then you start in the beginning and you follow through 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on. It's a teaching in itself. When I first started giving talks, I thought to myself, well, what koan should I select? No, it's not necessary. It's adding legs to the snake. We don't need that. These collections, when we get into them, teach us that what comes at the time will show the face of its timeliness. It appears when it needs to appear. And it's also interesting that case 46 in this Shumon Katoshu is all around the first case of the Mumon Kan, Joshu's Mu. Joshu's Mu, you remember, Joshu Muji or Joshu Kushi, Joshu's Papi. Yeah. Chinami ni soto, Joshu Osho, Chinami ni soto. Joshu Osho was asked by an approaching monk, Kushi ni kaete, Busho Ariyamata inaya. When it comes to a little dog, does it have Buddha nature or not? Shu iwaku mu, and Joshu answered, Mah. I don't know if he said it like that, but that's how everybody says it. So maybe he certainly didn't say it that way. You know why? He was Chinese. What would we have said in Chinese? Wu, right? Written with a W. Yeah. That is, that first case is number 46 in the Shumon Katoshu. And there are six sub-cases of it. So for six talks, I was stuck in the Mu hell, you know? And one thinks in the beginning, oh my God, what can I say? But it turned out to be easily fillable. And now it happens to be in this session that the cases we have here, the first one was very short, and the second one, number 55, is equally as short. It might be a little bit amusing to you that we are dealing now with alcoholic beverages. Mr. Cho drinks wine. Mr. Li gets drunk. What could that have to do in the Zen tradition to begin with? There's no question here about Buddha, nature. There's no question here, what is Buddha? Well, we know that wine appears in several of the koans, yeah? But here, it's just very straightforward. And if you research it, then you find out that this actually is a line from a popular song of the early Tang dynasty. It's taken from a street song. Mr. Cho drinks wine, Mr. Li gets drunk. And then, of course, the Zen monks, as they picked it up in later times, they modified it just a little bit. So there are very various versions of this around. And one of them goes, the cow eats grass, the horse farts. Same thing. A Japanese Roshi who came to Bavaria changed it to the cow in Bavaria eats grass. The horse in Japan is satiated. Wonderful. So let's explore a little bit why this is wonderful. You might not think of it yet as being wonderful. I don't think we have to go into details who Mr. Cho was or Mr. Li. We should actually, in light of modern times, have a female version of this. Miss Cho drinks wine. Mrs. Li gets drunk. I don't know if we should mix the genders, because then we get into very difficult territory. We don't want to do that. Not today. So this line, even we can find in very early places, Ummon Bunen Zenji. Ummon Bunen Zenji's extensive talks are recorded in a work that is called the Ummon Zenji Heiroku. And there it is quoted just like this. And from that source, this koan stems. So what is this business about drinking wine? It doesn't have to be wine. It could be eating grass. The business of getting drunk, of farting, whatever it is. If we look at it, it sounds like this is a cause and effect story. But wait a minute. This is not wine, but if it were wine, I drink it now. Let me see who's getting drunk. Oh, Gento. Hold on to your chair. It is something that usually doesn't happen, right? It usually doesn't happen that one person ingests alcohol and somebody else gets drunk. So it couldn't be really that general understanding of cause and effect. When we look at such an understanding of almost Newtonian, straight line, logical cause and effect, A implies B, then we are getting closer to the subject of the koan. And that is, it wants to point out that we have to look very carefully at duality and at the great teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha and all the ancestors who we have, and even the Buddhas before Shakyamuni and the sages who lived for many years before. And that is the pointing to the non-dual nature of this. Yeah, we are Buddhists, or maybe not, but at least it has it in the name of this practice, Zen Buddhism. So the Buddha is very important, but by no means the first person who spoke about non-duality. And here comes the first rub. I happened to go and Google for it what comes up with non-duality. And the astounding thing is, you know, every book has an advertisement. There's a book, and it doesn't matter who wrote it. It's a wonderful person, actually, who wrote that book. Non-duality. A book that analyzes the various understandings of non-duality in blah, 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 blah. Weird, isn't it? But we need it. We need some kind of pointers to what non-duality, where it opens to us. And it is almost the same thing that we can find in Sesshin here. In order to become free and comfortable and at home with who we are and where we are and what is there at that very point, we have to experience the limitations. As I said to some of you, and as I said in the previous talk, these points of our schedule, of our practice, that create the friction are there to demonstrate to us where these rubbing points lie. It's the same when you go into a dark room. What do? You don't just walk straight into it. You put your hand on the walls and you feel your way around. And that is similar here, how we use words in pointing towards non-duality. We can use words to point clearly out how they don't work and how they don't capture what there is. And by having the experience of sitting zazen, of participating in this kind of a setup, or extracting ourselves and going to the lake and feeling the wind blow on our skin, or lying in the meadow, which I would not recommend because of the ticks, lying on the deck of Beecher House and looking up into the star-studded sky. Through those experiences, in combination with the words, we can find a path to clarify for ourselves what this non-duality is. Even before the Buddha, with language, Yajnavalkya was a sage in India, Yajnavalkya, and he was intricately involved in the generation of this idea of zero, you know, zero as this revolutionary thing that in itself is indivisible, that you can't divide anything by, but that in itself carries the whole potentiality of everything. And when zero appears in this real world here, it's also a very interesting teaching because it carries with it positionality. So where it is, where its position is within, if you get paid $0000001, it's very different as if you get paid $1000000000. So this Yajnavalkya, neti, he used to say, neti, not this, not that. But it is there. And this is here too. Neti, not this, not that. So it is there. There is something there. We here in the Zen tradition, we like to point to the third ancestor, Sōsan Kanchi Zenji, who wrote On Faith in Mind, Shinjin Mei, which in the seven-day session we read on the first day. It is a poem of some 34-line verses that express his, I would really say, distillation of what he had experienced under his teacher, the second ancestor, Eka Daiso Senji. So it has to do with that non-duality. Remember, it starts out, the highest path is not difficult. It is just beyond picking and choosing. That's one of the translations. The highest path is not difficult. Some people, Suzuki, I think D.T. Suzuki translated it, just avoid picking and choosing. The difficulty with a translation like that is that avoidance itself already is a choice, right? That also points us to the language. We have to be careful how we say things. So the highest path is not difficult. It has no difficulties. It has no choices. It has no preferences. That's what it says. I was taught that this activity of the Dharma, which we also could call the activity of nature, the activity maybe of time, the activity of karma even, works without will and desire. Ishi yokyu nashi. No will, no desire. In that sense, it is very much like natural forces such as gravity. See? That just works. It's not that there's a little man sitting in the middle of the earth saying, I want that. It's just happening. There's no will and desire behind it. There's no aversion to it. There is no love of it. It just happens. And when we learn to connect at first to this kind of understanding of this activity of Dharma, we might think, what? Is there no good in this universe? But then we realize that actually it has something very, very comforting to it, because suddenly it makes this activity not personal. Some horrible happens to you. I don't say the word right now. And you think, oh, what have I done? I am so rotten. Why does the universe punish me? In this teaching, shit just happens. It's not because we are a rotten person. Same thing, if you win the lottery, it's not because you are such a wonderful person or whatever. It just happens without will and desire. Hold on a moment. I hear somebody saying, what about karma? All the harmful karma ever committed by me since of old. Can any one of you show me their karma bank book? Is there a karma bank that keeps track of it? Some people think there is such a thing, and it is maybe a good concept that is much helpful to the development of society to have that concept that, well, if you do something that is not good for us as a whole, there will be effects. So society itself is such a bank of remembering and of seeing that cause and effect play out. But in a cosmic sense, if we combine it with the understanding of the activity of Dharma working without will and desire, suddenly it takes on a very, very different flavor. There is no past karma. There is no future karma. There is no bad karma. There is no good karma. There are only the conditions that eternally reveal the truth itself. Right now. Which puts us into the center of all of this activity, which tells us what we do really matters. The current conditions under which we exist, they manifest out of themselves. Of course they change, but they don't keep track of the past or project anything into the future. So we are getting closer to the main point of this koan. So when we understand karma and purification, we purify ourselves here. It's not karmic labor camp. Yeah? It's not karmic labor camp where we work off that kind of the bad things we have caused in the past. It is attending to the conditions as they are at this very moment. And how are they? I'm sure each of us could answer that question in a different way. But what we all can agree on is they are just as they are, however we interpret them. So if we are with what is, without ascribing to it any kind of descriptive notions, without superimposing any kind of concepts, without abstraction, without analysis, and we are really with it, without any distance, then we have an experience of non-duality. So Sōsan Kanchi Zenji says, a tenth of an inch's difference and heaven and earth are set apart. If you wish to see it before your own eyes, have no fixed thoughts either for or against it. We have all sat in Zazen, and there are these moments of clear samadhi while everything is as it is, while the legs hurt. But then as soon as our mind goes to, that hurts, I don't want to have that pain. That is the tenth of an inch of a difference. And heaven and earth are apart. And hell wins, especially if it's painful. So Sankanchi Zenji continues, abide not with dualism. Here again, Suzuki Daisetsu translated it, carefully avoid pursuing it. As soon as you have right and wrong, confusion ensues and mind is lost. Confusion ensues from these judgments. Now, please don't get me wrong. It doesn't say that judgments are not necessary, that judicious action is not necessary. It is very necessary. In this world of duality in which we live, we better choose carefully. But when it comes to the experience of non-duality, no judgment is involved. Here comes the next trap of language. Often we read, we have to transcend duality and we will enter into non-duality. That is, again, a model that is unidirectional. Not only is it unidirectional, it just underlines our belief, there is something more that I have not yet got. There is some kind of substance out there that I still have to acquire. Well, why do we think that way? Is it a fault, or is it just one of the basic human properties that we have? Well, it is just a human property. And actually, it is the property that brings us all here, namely the awareness, the deep awareness that we are incomplete. We are incomplete. We are born into this world as individuals, not complete. And we have the deep longing for completeness. And there are many different ways to seek for it. As individuals, we look for affection from another person who compliments us in a way that we may feel more complete. We may feel more complete when we do specific things, engage in a specific kind of practice like this. The telling of stories, how you can become complete, it's called religion. And some people even market that and make big money with it. That's not right. But so this wanting and the desire for the completion of our incomplete nature that we realize is very important. That's why we live in dualism. That's the incompleteness. Right and wrong. I'm also sure you have heard about the three marks of all existence that the Buddha taught about, the tri lakshana, anicca, dukkha, and anatta. Anicca is mujo, impermanence. Everything is changing. Again, an expression of that activity of Dharma. Dukkha, first translated as suffering, but a very limiting way to speak about it. Unsatisfactoriness, or the actual experience of what we just spoke about. Incompleteness. The awareness and experience of incompleteness is that dukkha. And there is anatta, muga, the non-fixated self, no inherent selfhood, no entity in any of us that is unchanging. So all of these three points, they point again to that non-duality. So Sankanchi also says, all in one. No, first we'll start with the two. The two exist because of the one, but hold not even to this one. When a mind is not disturbed, then the 10,000 things offer no offense. Now, I want to put that together with the transcending of duality. The idea, here's duality and we have to go beyond it, is an idea that can be a hindrance. So let us look at it from the point of view that the underlying truth is in itself non-dual. That's where we start. That is the ground we stand on. Same thing with consciousness. In self-consciousness, there is no higher consciousness. If there is anything, there is a more fundamental consciousness that is out of which self-consciousness and self arises. Remember the picture that Hakuin Zenji gives us about the person standing in the water, crying out in thirst so imploringly. That's our mind that's crying, please let it rain, there must be rain somewhere. But the water is the very foundation in which we are. So we do not have to go and look for non-duality. Seeing is non-duality. When the seer comes into existence. It's cut into two. Hearing is non-duality. When the hearer comes into existence, cut into two. That's how it is. Not something that is achievable at all. Not graspable at all. Inconceivable. Ingraspable. So what about the 10,000 things offering no offense? That's a fancy way of saying the same thing that Dogen Zenji said in the quote that I used in the last talk. When the self illuminates the 10,000 things, this kind of a self, 9,999, 10,000 things, they're all here. That is called delusion. That means there is a subject and an object. The subject of the self enumerates, it measures, it names, and then it starts living in those ideas, not realizing that those ideas originated out of this oneness. Now, how does it relate to our practice? The Zen master Joshu Jushin said, when he was asked by his students, "Master, people ask what you teach. What should we answer?" Joshu said, "When cold, cold. When hot, hot." Are you catching on? "But," says the brain, "hot only exists in opposition to cold." Yes, in the dualistic world it does. You go into the sauna, you overheat. There is no concept of cold. In another koan it says, "Mukanjo, let the heat kill you," means let the heat kill any idea of self and other. When cold, let the cold kill that tenth of an inch that Sōsan Kanchi spoke about. Same with breathing in our Zazen. We count our breath in the exercise of Sussokan. Yet it's not a counting in a dualist way, dualistic. We are not breath accountants. What we have to do with the counting is not count the breath like an accountant, but make every breath count. Quite different. The staying with it, the being with it, then there is no more in and out. There is only Let's all go into that non-dual space together. Let's chant a nice, low Mu together, please. Mu. Tenth of an inch appears. The world is back. But while we were doing that together, there was no difference between any of us. The wind, the breath. That is non-duality. And some might say, oh yeah, that's good. I will go around New York City and go, moo. You know, how long will it take to be hit by a bus? Also, a non-dual experience, but fatal. This is just one way of pointing it out. The openness to what is, without having that self interfere with self-consciousness, self-judgment, creation of self and other, is what opens for us the gate to this non-duality. But what we can bring with us is what we just did. We made complete relationship. The same complete relationship we make here when we lose ourselves in a gassho. We can take that out into the world. It just turns into it's so good to meet you. That's one way. This koan saying that there's no difference between Mr. Cho drinking wine and Mr. Lee getting drunk is a fancy way of speaking about this non-duality. But it actually also applies to this world, to this dual world in which we live. Because what we do matters. In the dualistic world, there is dualistic karma. There is cause and effect. There is the activity of engi, of pratitya samutpada, the dependent origination. The billiard balls, the pool balls that shoot around and run into each other. There is cause effect and effect. So we have to be careful in the human world what causes we set, even if we could think it doesn't matter because non-dualism, the universe doesn't care anyway, everything is non-dual, so who cares? That's our job, to care. It's our job to care in this world where we have a choice between caring and who cares. When we start to care in this world, we also open another gate into this non-dual action. We learn to make that relationship, and we become clear, even within the duality, that underlying everything is just non-dual. Now, one mention I want to make about clarity and seeing clearly. This practice clarifies a lot of things. When I was much younger, I started to learn the piano and I continued to play the wrong notes here and there. And it wasn't clear why. My fingers were fine. But then it turned out somebody said, maybe he doesn't see so well. And so they sent me to the eye doctor. And I went to the eye doctor and the guy said, well, I'm surprised that you can read music at all. And so I got glasses. I went and I picked up my glasses. I put them on. And I looked around. I saw, wow, everything's so clear. And I walked home and looked at what was familiar with this really new clarity. And I walked into a pole. So seeing clearly doesn't mean you will not walk into poles, because it also matters where you look. And it was a pole of a traffic sign. And to put insult to injury, you know what the sign said? Caution. So it is. So clarity is very important. We can become very clear about this non-duality. And still we have to be also clear where we look and what we choose in duality. We know this planet is in trouble through the choices that people make. So one good place to start is to look at our own choices within that duality and make them consciously. And I say choice and not decision. A decision to me sounds is like a pole that you ram somewhere into the earth and then you tie yourself to it. A choice is more dynamic. As the truth reveals itself, the choices appear. There's no need to put any stakes in it, because when you put a stake into the heart of this dynamic nature, you know what? We kill it. So even though things are non-dual as they are, we have choices to make and lessons to learn and keep lessons that we have learned, and learning to follow our intuition, what our heart is telling us. And make the changes in the non-duality also right here and now, as the perfect place, as the perfect time, as the perfect teaching, as the perfect teacher, as the perfect student. And when all of that comes together, then we do it again, and again, and again, and again. The path of the Buddha is without end. I vow. What do we vow? That's in the first one. The path of the Buddha is endless. We will follow it. And more than that, we will realize that we are it. So, as I said in the opening words to this Yogen Senzaki session, develop a firm connection to the ground. Tread lightly, and non-duality will be revealing itself to you as the highest path. Beyond any difficulty, beyond any picking and choosing.
This has been a Zen Study Society podcast. If you found it to be of interest, please consider making a donation by visiting zenstudies.org/donate. Thank you for listening.